next case is number 20-2341, the Tolliver Group, Inc. v. United States. Okay, Ms. Akers.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. The trial court's judgment should be reversed for three reasons. First, the trial court lacked jurisdiction to find the government liable for breach of implied warranty of performance. It's a bedrock principle of contract law that a claim must first be submitted to a contracting officer before the trial court enters judgment or hears the claim. Here, Tolliver never submitted a certified claim to the contracting officer that pled the operative facts for breach of implied warranty of performance or that provided the legal theory to the contracting officer. So there was no clear and unequivocal statement that could have ever alerted the contracting officer that Tolliver was raising this claim. In fact, the only operative facts that Tolliver asserted in its certified claim to the contracting officer was that it entered a contract with the United States government, that it performed under the contract, and that it was sued in a QI-TAM action. But none of the operative facts that are necessary to render a determination for breach of implied warranty of performance, such as whether the contractor was misled by the the specifications, whether the specifications were defective, whether there was reliance on the specifications, none of those operative facts were ever presented to the contracting officer. Similarly, Tolliver's certified claim never put forth the legal basis. There's nothing in the claim that asserted breach, reliance, that it was misled, or that its attorney's fees were proximately caused by the government's breach. And because the contracting officer never first issued a contracting officer final decision on that claim, the trial court inappropriately and impermissibly rendered judgment on that theory. And to be clear, this was not without great prejudice to the United States. We were never given an opportunity to brief these issues at the trial court because.
What about on reconsideration?
Your Honor, on reconsideration, our arguments are limited by the trial court's Rule 59 to new evidence or things that the trial court missed, for example, based on
but,
the.
I thought your point about the procedural impropriety, let's call it, is that the trial court, in ruling on the summary judgment motion, ruled on a ground that was not really part of it. I would think that that would be a perfectly wonderful ground for saying reconsider it, and because it's new, we need new procedures.
Did you say that there should be
more discovery, new motion, or?
No, we didn't, Your Honor, because a breach of implied warranty performance claim was never alleged in the complaint. And so we did argue that this was an impermissible insertion of a legal theory that was never raised. We did argue there was no jurisdiction, but...
Right, but your middle argument here is that you weren't given kind of a fair process for this. That seems to me really quite different from saying jurisdictionally it shouldn't have been there, and on its merits, it was meritless because things were not proven. But just on this fair process point, I guess I don't really understand why you couldn't have said in seeking reconsideration, we don't think you should be considering this, but if you do, then there's a whole process that hasn't taken place yet that we're entitled to.
We did note in our motion for reconsideration, Your Honor, that we were not given any opportunity for discovery on this issue. We also noted we were not given opportunity to brief the issue, and we asked that the court vacate its prior opinion so the court could have I suppose, allowed discovery, but it just simply denied our motion for reconsideration with very little explanation.
How would discovery have helped you?
Well, Your Honor, had we known that there was a breach of implied warranty of performance claim at issue in this case, we could have elicited discovery that Tolliver was aware of the lack of the technical data package, that Tolliver was never misled by that. We could have developed discovery showing that Tolliver successfully performed, which would have rendered a breach of implied warranty of performance claim defective. So we could have developed facts to our defense.
Can you tell me, so there's the pitch on the other side has a certain appeal, right? You all promised in the original contract to provide some information that would make the completion of the job easier. Undisputedly, you didn't provide that information. The job got a lot more expensive. You said, you directed them, continue on the job. You then negotiated an additional dollar figure, much larger dollar figure. But meanwhile, the United States, represented by Mr. Searle, imposes $200,000 of litigation costs on them. I attribute that, in their theory, to the government. So the government sues Tolliver, imposes $200,000 of costs for doing what the government said. Now, this seems something that cries out for the government should pay for that extra $200,000. How should that have happened?
Well, Your Honor, first, I think the factual predicate to your question is a little bit inaccurate. It is true that there was a modification that increased the contract value and increased the amount of work that was unrelated to the technical data package. And there is nothing in the record.
I'm not sure that helps your case, because then there wasn't even actually a chance that that was an extra payment that would encompass the damage that was about to occur when, through Mr. Searle, the government turns around and sues them.
Was there anything in that modification that gave them where they surrendered rights to an equitable adjustment or a breach claim?
No, Your Honor. Tolliver is entitled to seek an equitable adjustment if it has performed additional work. Tolliver did not perform additional work. In fact, it doesn't ever allege a claim.
But there's nothing about Mod 10 that prevents them from pursuing this theory.
Excuse me, Your Honor, I just can't understand.
There's nothing in Mod 10 that prevents them from pursuing this theory. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. That's correct, Your Honor. And Judge Toronto, to your question, the reason I raised that the additional money and the additional hours weren't related to the technical data package was because the government's failure to originally provide the technical data package had no impact whatsoever on Tolliver's ability to perform.
Except that the United States, through Mr. Searle, thought it was worth accusing them of fraud.
Well,
for and imposing $200,000 in litigation costs. That's an impact.
Well, Your Honor, first off, the relator's lawsuit alleged 9 independent claims. So that was one aspect of the claim. And it was simply a misunderstanding by the relator. That's what Tolliver argued.
A $200,000 costly misunderstanding.
Yes, Your Honor, those were the attorney's fees that were incurred by Tolliver because the relator misunderstood several aspects of the contract. And it's not the government's breach of an implied warranty of performance that caused that. It's the relator's misunderstanding of contract specifications.
So you're saying, part of what I couldn't quite tell from your brief is whether you're saying they're just out of luck. They actually had no legal claim they could have brought, or there might have been a legal claim, but they didn't bring the right one. So is there a legal claim that Tolliver could have brought?
Well, the claim that Tolliver did assert in its second amended complaint for an allowable cost under the FAR, Tolliver did bring that claim, and of course we were trying to litigate that claim, and the trial court...
That wasn't a viable claim because it was relying on a provision of the FAR that only applied to cost-plus contracts, right?
That was our argument, Your Honor, but the trial court never rendered any judgment on that.
So let me clarify. Is there a claim... A meritorious claim for the $200,000 that the United States, the counter-contracting party, through Mr. Searle, imposed on Tolliver?
Our position, Your Honor, is no. And the Supreme Court recognized that in the Hercules case. This court recognized that in the Rick's Mushroom case. It is unlikely that the government, the contracting officer, would ever agree, let alone implicitly warrant or provide an open-ended indemnification for attorney's fees for lawsuits for which we have no idea how much money the attorney's fees are going to be. We have no idea who's going to bring the lawsuits. So it's not
okay,
that...
But that's an argument, it seems to me, a good argument for a lack of proximate cause here. If the government weren't involved as the plaintiff itself in the QI-TAM suit. I mean, back up a moment. Help us understand what happens in these QI-TAM suits. I mean, it's clear that the government helped defeat the QI-TAM suit in the sense that the contracting officer, I guess, gave an affidavit or maybe testified also. But what? How many of these QI-TAM suits are there? What is the government policy about intervening and dismissing or not intervening? Can you answer that question?
I can't answer that, Your Honor, but I will note that the government, Your Honor is correct, didn't intervene or dismiss this QI-TAM action, but provided substantial assistance to Tolliver. And this court has held, and I would point Your Honor to the Woods case that I believe is cited in our papers, there's no lawsuit or cause of action for the government failing to intervene or dismiss a QI-TAM action. It's a discretionary matter left to the fraud section of the Department of Justice. And so just because the government didn't intervene or dismiss this lawsuit really is besides the point of what this court has to decide.
Well,
which
except
is,
that it looks as though the government, by allowing this to proceed, is imposing costs on the contractor that the contractor couldn't possibly have anticipated. So I guess the theory is, in a sense, these costs are being imposed by the government on the contractor, which is a cost resulting in some way from the breach of the obligation to provide the technical data.
That is the theory, Your Honor, but for this court's purpose, the trial court awarded costs, those attorney's fees, under a theory that is completely untenable on the facts.
Could there have been a cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing at whose core is the obligation of the other side of the contract not to take affirmative action to interfere with the other side's receipt of the contemplated benefits? That seems like a fairly apt description here. Of the government suing and imposing costs that could not have been contemplated.
I think, Your Honor, that would go back to the government's determination whether to dismiss the QI-TAM action, which is not actionable by a party. They can't sue the government for failing to intervene or for failing to dismiss a QI-TAM action, and that's well established.
Even if they breach the duty of good faith and fair dealing? Even if the government were to breach the duty of good faith and fair dealing in its contract with it?
I imagine, Your Honor, that could be a separate issue. I'm not actually familiar with that line of cases and the fraud section's ability or decisions to intervene or dismiss.
I'm just puzzled about why the government approaches it this way. I mean, they had the contract and also supply an affidavit. It must have been authorized to do that and to help defeat the action, but the easier way to do that would have been just to intervene and dismiss. I mean, I just don't understand what the government policy is in this area.
Yeah, Your Honor, and I'm sorry, but I don't know either, and I imagine that it's a fact-by-fact, case-by-case basis, and that goes to the internal deliberative process of the government. I'm not familiar with that in this case. There's no facts in the record to help Your Honor on that. But the trial court here imposed damages or liability on the government for these attorney's fees on a breach of implied warranty performance. And I think that it's worth noting quickly that the trial court never made any of the factual findings to support that theory, nor did it apply the elements that both the Supreme Court and this court have set forth for breach of implied warranty of performance. It is well established that to be found liable for that breach, the government must provide a defective specification, the contractor must have relied on and been misled by the specification, the contractor must not have successfully performed under the contract, and none of those elements here are supported by the factual record, nor did the trial court ever make findings to apply the facts to these elements. So the trial court fundamentally misapplied this breach of implied warranty of performance. There are no cases that we are aware of that the trial court cited or that Tolliver cited where a contractor has successfully performed the contract and yet the government has been found liable for breaching a warranty of performance. It doesn't make sense. The warranty is that performance can happen. Here, performance happened satisfactorily. There's no allegation that it was misled. And there's also been no case where attorney's fees have been awarded for the breach of implied warranty of performance.
Can I just ask, is it too late now for Tolliver to file a claim of with the contracting officer for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that they incurred the last attorney's fees less than 6 years ago, and I believe that we...
That would be the relevant limitations period?
Correct, and I believe we discussed that actually at one of the arguments before the trial court when the breach of implied warranty performance wasn't actually an issue because it was before the trial court had inserted it in its opinion for the first time. If there are no further questions,
we'll give you 2 minutes for
rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. English?
Good morning, and may it please the court. This court should affirm the claims court's judgment for three reasons. First, the claims court had jurisdiction to enter judgment on a defective specification theory because that theory arose out of the same operative facts and dealt with exactly the same remedy.
Well, the problem is that the letter to the contracting officer making the claim doesn't seem to mention the operative facts.
But there are only, in our view, three or four operative facts, Your Honor, and they were summed up in the sentence where Tolliver said that it got sued in the government's name for performing Task Order 10 exactly as the government directed. And in our view, the operative facts of this case are that the TDP was a part of the government-furnished information when Task Order 10 was awarded. The government didn't provide the TDP to Tolliver. It told Tolliver to perform without the TDP. Tolliver performed without the TDP.
But the judgment that we're reviewing from the Court of Federal Claims involved, as I recall it, and you can correct me if I'm mistaken about this, a theory that it was the breach of the obligation to provide the technical data package that was the breach rather than a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
I think that's certainly true, Your Honor. The issue...
So if that's correct, I'm not sure that I see that in the letter to the contracting officer.
What was in the letter to the contracting officer, in our view, was the theory that, one, we want to recover attorney's fees for defending this False Claims Act case, and two, that we incurred those fees because we performed expressly at the government's direction, i.e. without the TDP. And those are the facts that Senior Judge Leto applied when he entered his order. His view of the specification was the statement in the contract that required the government to provide the TDP.
Well, where's the language of the letter that you think supports you? I forget what the...
Let me see if I can find some.
I think it's a 2010. But...
Your Honor, it is the closing paragraph or second to last paragraph of the certified claim from Tolliver, if I can find the page.
110?
110.
That's what I'm looking at. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing.
Yes.
The sentence that's right, that begins, however, after the footnote call.
Right. It is exactly as Judge Toronto pointed out, Your Honor. Are you there?
Now,
the underline.
Thank you. 110. I had the wrong page.
Yes, Your Honor. So it's 110. It is the last real paragraph before the closing paragraph above Mr. Wood's signature, about four lines from the bottom. However, this was not until after TTGI, which is the acronym we use for Tolliver, was forced to incur significant costs to defend itself for performing under the contract exactly how it was instructed to by the government. And so that's the sentence that we think encapsulates those four or five operative facts that I just went through that was at the heart of Mr. Searle's claim. As Judge Hilton in the Eastern District of Virginia found, and also the Fourth District, the gravamen of the claim was that Mr. Searle believed Tolliver couldn't certify these manuals unless it had the TDP. And so as originally prepared...
But where does this suggest there was a breach by the government? That's what's missing, it seems to me.
Yeah, there's a way to read the sentence as saying simply, in summary, we were successful in defense against this False Claims Act case, but by the time we finally, by the time the litigation was completed, we had incurred significant costs.
Right. So, I mean, to be clear, we did not allege breach in this certified claim. This was a request for equitable adjustment. And there are some theories of recovery that can be supported.
But not for equitable adjustment as related to the government's failure to provide the technical data package.
That is what was intended by that sentence, Your Honor. It is the fact of the underlying litigation. Both Judge Hilton and the Fourth Circuit specifically found that the gravamen of the case was the failure of the government to provide the TDP. And so when Mr. Searle first filed his complaint, we moved to dismiss it, and
on the face of it, this seems to be a claim under the cost aspects of the FAR, where you can, if successful in a QI-TAM action, recover 80% of the fees. And you're not, that's not the theory that you prevailed on in the Court of Federal Claims. It's not a theory that you're articulating now, right?
But the first time, to be absolutely fair, the first time anybody saw the theory that we prevailed on was when we read Senior Judge Leto's order. I just don't think I can dispute that. But my point would still be that there are only four operative facts. And it's the ones, as we see it, that I articulated a moment ago. And any claim that can be supported by equitable adjustment, and we've cited the cases that show that defective specification can be redressable with an equitable adjustment, and it can be redressable with a breach. It can be either. That any claim that can be redressable by equitable adjustment that arose out of those facts is one that was within the court's jurisdiction, as we see it. And again, I would say that at the trial court level, the Eastern District of Virginia, Judge Hilton dismissed Mr. Sherrill's complaint because we argued that Mod 8 removed the TDP from the list of items that the government had to provide. And then Mr. Searle amended his complaint and focused on that 8-month period where we performed without the TDP at the government's express direction before Mod 8. And so that was the gravamen of the lawsuit. As Your Honors have noted, the government was a party by virtue of the False Claims Act's procedures just through Mr. Searle, but they were also a participant. The COR, Mr. Travis Christner, provided an extensive declaration.
COR?
Contracting Officer's Representative.
To help you.
They did help us, Your Honor. I mean, there's no question about that either, but they put us in that position.
Did you ask them to intervene and dismiss the case?
We did.
And do we have their response to that in here?
There are no written responses. My understanding, and this is just what I understood, was that there was a request made at the agency level. The agency agreed with it. It went to the Eastern District of Virginia. At the time, I think Dana Bente was the U.S. attorney for that district. And as I understood it, he consented. And then it went to Maine Justice. And as I understand it, the Maine Justice withheld consent. And I don't know why.
Assuming your reading of your claim, your letter to the contracting officer is correct, is it your view that the contracting officer here made a mistake in how she responded to this letter? She overlooked your theory that there was a breach of the warranty?
Well, again,
an objectively reasonable contracting officer reading this letter would have been able to identify a breach of implied warranty and then therefore should have addressed that issue.
But specifically, Your Honor, I would say that the cases that have dealt with, is it the same claim? have generally focused on the underlying facts and the specific type of remedy when determining whether the claim is the same as the one in the original certified claim.
Right, but overall, the objective is to give the government notice. Right?
That is, notice is certainly the most important element of the CDA statute as it relates to the requirement to submit the claim. But what I would say in response to Your Honor's question specifically is that the contracting officer absolutely had notice that Tolliver sought an equitable adjustment, as opposed to a breach of contract. We traveled down the equitable adjustment theory on purpose, and that was the route we took. And it certainly knew, the contracting officer certainly knew, that the basis of the claim was the attorney's fees that were incurred for defending the False Claims Act.
But not the fact that the government failed to supply the technical data package.
I would disagree with that respectfully, Judge Dyke, because the contract, again, we have the statement on page 110. We also have the underlying cases, which made it clear that we were sued because the government didn't provide the TDP. That is the finding that both the district court and the Fourth Circuit made, and I don't think the government...
Sure, and those were attached to the claim?
They were attached to the claim.
And when you said the contracting officer's representative...
Yes, Your Honor.
...filed something in the False Claims Act case...
That's right, Your Honor.
...does that mean that... what's her name? The contracting officer, Ms. Colica, would have known what her representative was doing in the case?
We certainly would have expected that he couldn't have participated, Mr. Christner, the COR, the representative, without the contracting officer's knowledge and consent. But the way we had to obtain that, as this court probably knows, is we had to submit a TUI request to the Army to provide the information we needed for the defense of the case, and they directed us to speak to Mr. Christner, who was the COR. Mr. Christner gave us an interview and then an extensive affidavit or declaration, which was the basis of the district court's findings of fact. He just laid it out almost verbatim as accepting that statement of fact. And we cited in the brief, I can't specifically cite it directly to your honors at the moment, but again, both courts, the Fourth Circuit and the district court, found that the basis of the suit was the absence of the TDP. So I don't think the government can dispute knowing that, again, because they were a party and also because they were a participant. And then we provided the cases, the opinions, as part of the claim. And so we think the notice element that you were asking about, Judge Chin, has been met as it relates to equitable adjustment for performing exactly as the government directed, and the amount we sought was exactly the amount that's allowable under the regulation, and that Judge Leto awarded to us. And so we cite the regulation because regardless of the nature of the basis.
What about the other elements that the government, other elements of a so-called Spearin claim that the government relies on?
Well, Senior Judge Leto addressed them generally. Number one, as it relates to reliance. If the court holds that in order to have reliance, it has to be something that was present at the time of a bid, then we couldn't satisfy that element because we took this contract by novation. Tolliver was not even the original bidder. But what Judge Leto found was that the reliance was obvious because of the change in the amount of the work with Mod 8. It went up $6 million after the government was unable to provide the TDP, and the period of performance was extended substantially.
I guess my question could have been understood, as I think you just did understand it, to go to the merits of Judge Leto's ruling. I was actually thinking about the facts that seem relevant to the merits, that whatever else one might say about the claim you made on June 15th, 2017,
right.
It's hard to see those facts presented in that claim.
Well, I think the reliance, the only evidence we would have to present even in a claim on the merits would be that, exactly as I laid out, that the mod had to increase the period of performance and it had to extend increase the amount of work because we didn't get the TDP. And those are findings, again, that are at least mentioned in the contracting officer's declaration, which are part of the cases that were decided in the Eastern District and the Fourth Circuit. And it's discussed in those opinions that there was a mod that increased the period of performance and the value. And the Mod 8 recites as its basis, the government's basis, that they underestimated the amount of work that was going to be required. And then it's also important to note, I think, that there is a specific finding by Judge Hilton where he found that all of the work Tolliver did was either reverse engineering or 100% hands-on validation. And so that finding at the district court level is also binding on the government. And so I think the facts that are binding on the government in a case where the government was the plaintiff and where it was a participant that are reflected in those opinions that were submitted to the contracting officer as part of the certified claim are certainly things that would have put her on notice of what the issue was. And so...
Can I ask you this question?
Sure.
Suppose, just for purposes of this question, that we think that this was a sufficiently different claim from what the June 2017 filing with the contracting officer put her on notice of. What does our judgment here look like?
If Your Honor makes that finding, then I think you would have to determine that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to enter this judgment. And so you would remand it, and then there's a number of ways we could potentially address it at the trial court level. That Judge Leto could remand it to the agency to let us... make another claim or to rule on the claim as he's presented it, and potentially we could just make a new claim.
I think Ms. Akers said that the six-year period has not run on your making a
I think that's right.
To the contracting officer.
The sixth year from the affirmance by the federal for the Fourth Circuit was, I believe, in 17. And so that's when the judgment became final. So we're certainly within 6 years of that, Your Honors. So I would agree that we have not missed the period if the court reaches the conclusion that Judge Leto didn't have jurisdiction. And for the reasons I mentioned, we believe otherwise. My time has expired, so if there are no more questions, I'll take my seat.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Akers?
Thank you, Your Honor. Two brief points. First, Mr. English admitted here today that the claim did not involve any legal theory involving breach of implied warranty of performance, and this defeats the trial court's jurisdiction. I would point Your Honors to the
case. I guess he's arguing, though, that it's the same facts. He's claiming that the same facts were alleged in his letter to the contracting officer that were relied on for finding a breach of implied warranty.
That's correct, Your Honor. But this court's well-established precedent, for example, the KCON case, provides that the contractor must provide a clear and unequivocal basis that provides adequate notice to the contracting officer of the remedy sought, and it must not assert claims that are legally or factually different than the ones the trial court hears. So the operative facts is an element.
I'm not sure that if it's the same nucleus of operative facts that if the contractor characterized it as an equitable adjustment claim rather than a breach claim, that would be sufficiently different to deprive the Court of Federal Claims of jurisdiction. So why don't you address the question of whether we're talking about the same nucleus of operative facts?
Well, Your Honor, Tolliver also admits that the operative facts are not in the claim. There's no allegation regarding whether Tolliver was misled by the defective specification. That is a crucial element to this breach of implied warranty performance claim. There's no allegation that it did not successfully perform, which is another operative fact that's material to make this determination of liability. And it did not allege that
One thing I'm a little confused about. So the specification, to borrow that term from Spearman, that is the thing the government said you, the contractor, must do, I'm confused whether it's what was in original Task Force Order 10 or in the non-written, I gather, directive from the contracting officer after the government couldn't get the technical data package or whatever it is. Go ahead without that. I guess I sort of increasingly think that the defective specification is that second thing, not the first thing. And they did rely on it because you said, keep up your work, and Tolliver did keep up your work, and what happened was that the government turned around and sued and imposed $200,000 in costs.
Well, Your Honor, the trial court found the defect was the lack of the technical data package, and the technical data package was in that original specification. It was subsequently modified out. But that doesn't even matter because Tolliver has admitted time and time again that it never intended to rely on the technical data package and it didn't need it for performance. So if that's true, which is what Tolliver put in its pleadings in the key time action, how then could it have been misled by not receiving the technical
Tolliver
data package?
Tolliver said it never intended to rely on it.
Correct, Your Honor. And we cite that in our brief and cite the appendix pages. It said it several times that it never intended to rely on it, they didn't need it, and it was merely a list of definitions. So if that's true, and Tolliver never had...
Well, what if the defect was the command, keep up your work, even though we're not going to give you this technical data package?
If that were somehow...
No, that was the basis on which you sued him, right?
On which Mr. Sherrill...
Still you.
That was one of the 9 bases that Mr. Sherrill sued Tolliver. That's correct, Your Honor. And so not only does the court not have trial court not have jurisdiction for the different claim reasons, but Mr. English also here today admitted that there are not facts sufficient to fulfill the elements of Spearin liability. There's no design specification. There's not even an allegation that there was, which is a fundamental element of Spearin liability. We've talked about not being misled. There was successful performance. And there's never been a case where the court has awarded attorney's fees for breach of implied warranty of performance. So even if we get over the jurisdictional question, the trial court fundamentally misapplied and expanded Spearin liability far beyond what this court, the Supreme Court, or even what the Court of Federal Claims has ever applied. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ayers. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.